The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM Today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
One of the great challenges for researchers studying the health of freshwater lakes and rivers is seeing under the waves and around all that mud and sand that are often part of the environment. It takes a lot of hard work, ingenuity, and even some special tools to get the job done. On this edition of UWM Today, we learn about the role that drone aircraft and aquatic robots play in gathering data from under the water. Joining us is Tom Consey, assistant professor with a joint appointment in UWM's College of Engineering and Applied Science and the University School of Freshwater Science. Tom, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us today.
Well, thank you for having me on the program.
And we're thrilled to hear you discuss ways in which you're using some pretty interesting tools to gather information, both for yourself and for your fellow scientist here at UWM. Talk about the drones first. I'm intrigued with the use of airplanes to gather data. Where did that idea come from here?
Well, we've been working earlier on aquatic robots and aquatic instrumentation in the lab. And about 2 years ago, my students started asking me if we could start working on drones because it was fun. And I hemmed and hawed for a while, and then I thought, okay, well, let's just get something and get a small plane and see what we can do with it. And while doing that, I ran into actually a person who was on the show not long ago, Fred Binkowski. And besides being in aquaculture, he also works with sturgeon, in particular restocking sturgeon in the lakes and rivers of Wisconsin, and studying their behavior. And the way they study them is to put radio tags inside the sturgeon and fly little airplanes over, say, the Wolf River, and look for beeps, because these radio tags are essentially little Morse code transmitters. So they fly around until they hear a beep, and they maximize the signal, and then they take a GPS fix, and that's presumably where the sturgeon is. And then they'll go on and fly to find the next sturgeon. The tags have slightly different frequencies, so they can tell who's who. And this has been going on for years, and it's really yielded a lot of good information about sturgeon breeding grounds and feeding, and just in general, what a large fish like this does in its natural environment. So Fred said casually, well, why don't you try and automate this procedure for me?
Because now he was doing this in a real airplane.
Right.
He was up in a plane.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Actually, Fred took me up last spring, and it's fascinating. It's fascinating to fly in a little plane so close, so perilously close to the river. But after a few hours of it, it's quite boring. We spent a whole morning trying to find four fish, and we came up with three. This is not to put down the procedure. Indeed, all we know about large fish is through this kind of tracking or with other types of techniques like acoustic tracking. But it is very tedious, and the data return is very low. So one could imagine if I could take a small autonomous airplane, essentially a model airplane, and fly it every day, and fly it very low so I get high signal strength, I can get a lot more data and a lot more dynamic data, not just the sturgeon is here on one day and 25 miles away on another day. I could follow the sturgeon's path and get even more information about, you know, their habitat, where they're eating in particular, where they're breeding and things like that. So that's really where the project started. We started knocking around that idea, and then we got a little funding and support to build the sturgeon tracker, and that's what we're working on right now.
I understand that you had some special challenges because the equipment that you need to receive that radio signal coming off of the fish is fairly heavy, and you had to make some adaptations on the airplane.
Well, this is a major issue. In if you're building a robot to do science, you have to make sure that your data has a certain level of quality. I can't just slap any old radio transmitter on there and say, here, Fred, look, we got some data. You want to have data that can match the data that was gathered by the scientists in previous missions, previous expeditions. So you can say, well, our data is as good, and then you can move on from there. So we were confined to lofting a 5-pound telemetry radio, which was about 8 inches by 5 inches by 5 inches. Doesn't sound like much to you, but to a model airplane, that's awful heavy. So we had to do a big search and find the essentially fattest model airplane we could find, and then do a lot of adaptation of that to accommodate the radio.
You worked with other people on this project. You mentioned Fred, who's one of the scientists who's going to be using the data. You also were working with those students who first said, hey, let's use planes, let's use drones.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this, this sort of whole project initially started, I wasn't really that much involved in aerial vehicles. I mean, I thought they were very interesting. But yeah, it was mostly students nagging me to buy an airplane and let's try this out. So we purchased a hexacopter. It's a six-propellered helicopter-type vehicle and also a small model airplane. We decided to go with an airplane airframe because that's the most efficient for traveling long distances. We have to go over lakes like Lake Poygan and Lake Winneconne and also up the Wolf River, so we'll be going tens of miles. And the multicopters, you've seen them. When most people think of drones, they think of these little hovering craft. Well, they're very nice for inspection, say going up and down a building, but they don't have the payload capacity or the duration for long-range flying. So it's like the analogy between, say, a bee and a bird. A bee can hover around and go up and down, but it takes a lot of energy. Bees eat honey. You know, bees eat sugar. That's as energetic as you get. Whereas a bird can take advantage of lift and air currents and fly long, long distances for roughly the same amount of energy. So we're using the bird-style vehicle, which is conventionally known as an airplane.
Somebody has to operate the drone. Where does that take place? Are you back in a laboratory, or do you have to be somewhere in the vicinity of where this drone is, mm-hmm. alongside one of the lakes or the streams that that you're monitoring?
Yeah. Well, we're not at the level of Langley and the CIA drone. So we operate actually in a model airplane field, and my students fly the planes. I'm absolutely awful at flying these things, so they won't let me touch them.
You don't play enough video games, right?
I guess not. But they have a real knack. And so at the moment, we manually take off, and then the autopilot, we use a conventional model airplane transmitter. They might be familiar to a lot of your listeners, just a box with multiple joysticks on it. And then we can send a signal to the autopilot that says, okay, stop listening to the transmitter and do your autonomous flight, which would make the plane go from point to point in the sky, basically GPS point to GPS point. So we can run any pattern, a lawnmower survey, for instance, going back and forth, say, over the lake, or a spiral, or anything we want. And then once the mission's done, we can flick a switch on our handheld controller, which will then tell the autopilot, stop being autonomous and listen to the ground, and then we can have somebody land the vehicle. Because takeoff and landing are the most sort of complicated parts, and the autopilots aren't quite up to that yet. So, but we always have a flyer in the field within sight of the vehicle.
Wow. Are there other people doing this sort of work? Do you see scientists involved in lake research or aquatic research routinely using drones?
Well, not in Wisconsin. There is a lot. This work has been going on for years in the area of agricultural scanning, where you can do air sampling. For instance, you have a filter, you suck in the air, and they'll look for weed seeds or fungal spores. I mean, these are the diseases that rip through cornfields and wheat fields and things like that. So there have been a number of universities building drone aircraft for that, which is a wonderful application. You could even expand that to human health and look at the transport of airborne diseases. For instance, in the Gulf of Mexico, when there's a certain kinds of red tide, people on the beach get respiratory illnesses because the waves aerosolize or shoot the red tide organisms up in the air, and people breathe them in, you know. So conventionally, we beach monitor by sampling the water. Well, maybe we're going to have to start beach monitoring by sampling the air as well.
Wow. Wow. How many miles can these planes fly once they get up and begin their research work?
Our current large sturgeon tracking plane could probably go, 5 miles. We use gas engines because the energy density of hydrocarbon fuel is just vastly greater than batteries, than the current kind of batteries we can get. So for really, for doing our type of mission, which is miles and miles and miles, we use gas engines. We use the little glow engines, which are the conventional model airplane engines for our smaller planes. And for the big Sturgeon Tracker, we use actually gas engine. Or some people come when they see it, they go, oh, a weed whacker engine. So it's a 30cc internal combustion engine. But we have to use gasoline essentially for the energy density. Batteries just won't cut it for the distances we need and for the kind of payloads we need to carry.
Now, that's a noisier engine than a battery-operated mm-hmm. engine. Does the noise disturb the research subjects, those fish that you're looking for?
The short answer is I don't know. I would say not because the engines actually, these engines, the hobby industry has been at this for decades in terms of perfecting these low-cost components. So there's really quite an array of really nice pre-engineered parts we can use. And these engines aren't nearly as noisy as I thought they'd be. And once they're up in the sky, of course, they're even less noisy. So it could be an issue. It's something we have to look at, especially if we do very, very low-level tracking. We have a bit of an advantage because a sturgeon is a bottom-dwelling fish. You know, I mean, if you just look at them, they have flat bottoms. Well, I encourage all the listeners to look at sturgeon because they're really marvelous. They're like dinosaurs. But anyway, so they're bottom-dwelling fish, so it would take quite a lot of sound energy to penetrate there to scare them.
How deep down do these fish typically go when you—
Well, to the bottom of a river, however deep the river is. One of the problems with aerial tracking is when there's a sharp bend in the river, the water scours a deep zone, and the planes can lose the signal because water does attenuate radio signals. And if you go deeper, you'll eventually lose the signal. Mm-hmm. So the idea is one of the big advantages of our planes is we could potentially, notice I say potentially, we haven't done it yet. I believe in truth in advertising. We could potentially fly very close and literally follow a river, which a piloted plane can't do. It's just not safe. You know, you'd potentially crash into the trees on either side. But our little planes could potentially do that and get very, very close and really pinpoint the location of the sturgeon or act in concert, say, with autonomous boats. So if we locate a sturgeon within a radius of 100 meters, we can then deploy a boat which can actually sit right on top of that animal and get more information out of it. Right. Furthermore, and this is another thing we've started experimenting with, is water launching and recovery for the practical reason of we don't often have model airplane fields next to where we want to look for sturgeon, and also the water is a perfect field. A launch and recovery pad, it's absolutely flat, okay? From a scientific point of view, and this is really exciting, if we can autonomously land, say we find a sturgeon, we land, and in our pontoons, we have spring-loaded syringes. We suck a water sample or drop a temperature sensor. So we not only can find out, well, here's a sturgeon in this part of this river, but we know what the pH of the river is. We know the turbidity. We know all that kind of stuff that the freshwater scientists want to know.
So the better you are at pulling data in, the more likely that research scientist is going to be able to discover what it means, discover the path that these fish take.
Right, because if you look at current papers where they do aerial tracking, there's a lot of question between, well, I know the fish is somewhere there, but what is there? You know, what is happening? Another exciting new avenue of this, just a few weeks ago, I was at a conference on fish passage, which was all about fish ladders and when you destroy a dam, how do you make sure a fish can get back up the river? You know, I was thinking, what happens if there's a natural disaster or a bridge collapses in a river? Well, now the migration pattern of your fish, it doesn't just have to be sturgeon, could radically change. So our planes can get rapidly deployed, and if we have tagged fish in the area, we could see how they're coping with this. You know, are they just aggregating some area and dying, or are they finding new streams that they can go up? Who knows? But we can get a rapid response, and that's really one of the great advantages of robotic-based data acquisition. You can get the information, enough information for you to actually look at the dynamics of whatever phenomena you're trying to get. So I like to say it's not enough to have a sensor. You have to put the sensor in the right place at the right time with the right frequency. in order to get your data. And human-based sensing, well, that's the human-based instrument deployment. Well, that's, I'd say, the gold standard against which all our data is compared. You just can't get out in the environment fast enough. And also, if it's there's a storm or other conditions, it could be just too dangerous. Okay, and that's a really good application for robots.
And we're going to talk about that next. But first, let me remind listeners that you're listening to UWM Today right here on WUWM. So good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in the studio is Tom Concy. Tom is assistant professor in UWM's College of Engineering and Applied Science and UWM's School of Freshwater Sciences. He has a joint appointment because I think he has a unique assignment here, working on building equipment, running equipment that helps gather data, and in this case, a lot of the data being used by the scientist at the School of Freshwater Science. We've been spending the first part of the program talking about the drones, the airplanes that you folks build and send out to gather data. But really, you began your work here at UWM, as I understand it, on robots that go into the water as opposed to flying above the water.
Right. Prior to getting into our drone work, we worked on a surf zone robot named Lamar for Lake Michigan Amphibious Robot. And this came out of an observation that people do a lot of coastal sampling. One of the big public health issues is the beach safe to swim in? And in particular, you want to make sure that there's no human contamination in the water. So they'll do things like sample the water and look for E. coli and other indicator organisms. So that's done. And by the time you can make a determination that the beach is safe or not, it could be the next day. So then you don't know if those conditions still exist. So are the people swimming in avoiding water that they can swim in, or are they swimming in water that's no good?
So, and finding out the next day, oops, I shouldn't have been swimming in that water.
Now, that's been alleviated a great deal with, it's got nothing to do with robotics, with new molecular biology techniques to, instead of relying on culturing these organisms, you can directly look at the DNA and amplify it. One of the techniques is called PCR. So that can reduce the time from a day or two to hours, okay? But robots have a place in this. For one thing, robots can go, say, at 3 a.m. Okay, rather than have human samplers wait for sunrise when it's safe. Okay, so then they could literally take the samples back very early in the morning to go through these new techniques. And then sort of the holy grail is to be able to tell people whether or not it's safe to come to the beach before they get in the car. Like, I think it's before 11 a.m. or something like that. We'll assume it's Saturday. Everybody's sleeping late. So potentially then robots can use that time in the morning, which is perfectly fine for sampling, but which people don't use for safety reasons. Okay, and robots could also sample more extensively in the water. Don't forget, things aren't homogeneous. They're patchy. You can have a cloud of something moving in, you know, so your water might say, oh, it's perfectly fine, but there's this cloud of nasties over here. So our robots could do large zigzag patterns through the beach and be constantly monitoring. And from a the point of view of scientific research, very little is known what happens in the coastal zone during storms. During storms, you have huge waves come in, the bottom gets riled up, things get, as the scientists would say, mobilized, okay? And if you're studying beach erosion, just the movement of particles, or you're studying the propagation of contaminants, whether they be chemicals or bacteria, it's good to know what's going on during these storm events when we have virtually no data. It's kind of sobering to know that just, you know, the surf zone that you paddle around in during the summer, during the winter is as unknown as, you know, as the moon or whatever. So my robot, Lamar, is designed to be able to bust into the waves. You know, it's pretty old-fashioned kind of heavy robot, and it could sit there and take data for as long as you want. Don't forget, robots don't have to move all the time. But it can come back to, as I'd like to say, come back to tell the tale, meaning come back to dump your data.
Talk about dumping the data. When you use the drones, you have the aerial transmitters, and so your radio frequency is alive with this data stream. When you're looking at a drone, is it gathering and containing that data somewhere on a disk on the robot itself, or could you also use radio transmitters to shoot it back to the lab?
Well, we use both. Our current radio transmitters don't have much of a range. It's always good if you can to transmit data back, because then if you lose the robot, and by the way, in field robotics, it's not a question of if you will lose the robot, you will lose the robot. So you have to be psychologically prepared for that. It also adds to the excitement of the field. But I mean, you want some level of reliability that you're going to not lose it on every outing. You know, it's not a disposable thing. But it's good if you can transmit data back that way. You know, if something happens and this, a catastrophe happens, you lose the robot, you get some of your data back. So we you would usually do both. You'd store it on board and you would transmit as much as you can back. And nowadays, with solid-state disks and low-cost memory, it really is not giving us a power or a volume hit. And these robots, don't forget, both power and space is at a premium. So it's not that big a deal anymore to have a huge amount of storage space on your robot.
How many robots have you built?
Well, we've built about three aerial robots, Lamar, a bunch of smaller sort of prototypes, a walking robot. So I haven't really added them all up. And then in my previous life, I had had a hand in a few robots as well. So a few tens of robots, I guess.
Yeah, and they keep evolving, as you pointed out a moment ago. Memory storage, the data storage, keeps getting better and better. Are there things mechanically that are improved today on the robots from the ones you might have been building 5 or 10 years ago?
Well, that's an interesting issue because electronics, because of microfabrication techniques, electronics scales, you know, with volume. If I'm selling a million chips, I can make them very, very cheap. Mechanics don't scale so well because there's a certain amount of hand assembly involved. And that's been a problem with, you know, mechatronic devices, things that are computer-controlled machines, essentially. So robots have an intrinsic cost. I've always been interested in toys, not just to play with them, although that's what I do, but in how they're built. Okay, they're very, 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 very cheaply made. They're made of plastic, but the robotic toys pretty much do what they say they're going to do. Also, if you look at things like printers, if you ever take apart a printer, which I recommend you do, it's a good source of stepping motors. But anyway, if you take apart a printer, you see it's all sheet metal and plastic. So there are ways of making devices that are precision. I mean, a printer has you can tell if a printer is doing something wrong. You can easily pick up, you know, some change in the font or whatever, some distortion. But it's made in a pretty sort of inexpensive manner, and it's the control which then compensates for that. So one could imagine in the future that you have something that's kind of sloppily made, but it's loaded with sensors and the appropriate computer program, and it sort of grows up a little bit, you know, like a baby learning to walk. So you have your robot, you turn it on, maybe you have an environmental chamber, you subject it to the various extreme environments it's going to see, and then it learns how to fly or wiggle or whatever it's supposed to do. And then when it comes out of that, it's good to go. Okay, but you're not relying on precision machining. That stuff never scales with volume. And if you want something precisely made, you have to make it precisely, and that takes a lot of hours.
Tom, you talked about the great challenge of understanding what's going on in these lakes and in these streams, because looking at Lake Michigan, it's such a vast, vast tract of land under that water. How far can these robots go? You're doing beach monitoring now. Can you go out 100, 200 feet, 300 feet down with these robots?
Well, it's interesting. You don't have to be in Lake Michigan to be amazed at how big a body of water is. Years ago, we had an AUV that went down about 15 feet off the dock, and we couldn't see it because the water was murky and we had no idea where it was. So underwater is a lot bigger than you think of it is when you actually lose something. But there have been marine robots, in particular robots called gliders, which have done transatlantic runs. And there's a group at a place called MBARI, Monterey Bay Research Aquarium Institute, that have made a very, very high efficiency vehicle, and they've been going to Hawaii. There's another group that does a nice hybrid vehicle which uses wave action, and that's been out, I don't know if they've done a year duration. So in terms of the marine vehicles, the duration has really been pushed up. It's quite impressive what's going on.
Will there be a day in the near future where we could have robots all over the bottom of Lake Michigan discovering the secrets of that lake?
Yes, potentially you could send. I mean, some people do. We've operated an AUV when I first came here. But given the scale of Lake Michigan, it is big, but it's not super big. And I would suggest an alternative, and that is a cabled observatory. In other words, a whole network of cables under the lake with data gathering stations, and you could have essentially upside down buoys that go from the bottom and go to the top. So these things could be streaming live data in. And the reason I say cable rather than buoys is because they could survive the winter. So even though I do robotics, I'm very honest about their capabilities. And if I could think of another technology that would be equal or better, then, you know, I'd say go for that, you know. So that, I think cable technology would be very, very good with bottom stations. There's large offshore observatories being built, especially in the Pacific Northwest. We should follow that. And however, robots can fill in the gaps. Whether it's buoys or underwater nodes, you still have the vast quantity of water in between. Okay, so robots can fill in the gaps between your buoys. They can also be deployed rapidly during episodic events like storms or if a plane goes down in the lake or something like that.
You talked about the enthusiasm of the students. They've got to love this, don't they, when they're building a robot or actually operating a robot?
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, robotics is sort of the natural student magnet at all levels. And it really is a great platform for engineering education because the reality of it is whatever job they take, they're going to be not working on a single type of engineering. They're going to be probably part of a team interacting with people from electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, and other engineering disciplines. So they have to learn how to at least become conversant in areas outside their own. Plus, you have robots really allow you to play with the dynamics of these engineered systems. It's not just a matter of them turning on and off. You have to see how they react when they are presented with unknown stimulus. The fact that they go out in the wild, you know, is both exciting and it's a real intellectual challenge. And that's actually one of the sort of the intellectual edges of this field. You know, when you have a robot going into a particularly unpredictable environment, how are you going to how is it going to survive? And that's a huge challenge. But yes, the students love it. And from my point of view, I hope it inspires them to actually take the hard courses. I'm a really firm believer in a hard-nosed engineering education, and it's often hard in engineering programs because it is a difficult major. And in the beginning, the students just have to take a certain amount of, say, math and physics, which can get a little dry, especially if it's poorly presented. And often you lose students. So, but if your students can work in a lab and sort of see the light at the end of the tunnel, they could be inspired.
Well, you've inspired us today. Fascinating conversation, Tom, and we wish you continued success as you work with the robots and the drones, and Lord knows what else might be coming down the pike for you as you help the scientists in the School of Freshwater Science gather data. Thanks so much for joining us.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Tom Concy, assistant professor with a joint appointment in the College of Engineering and Applied Science and UWM School of Freshwater Sciences, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. Well, that's all for this week's program. We will see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Newjack.
You have been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.